In mid-May, we met up with Jay Carlisle, Research Director, Associate Research Professor for Intermountain Bird Observatory at Boise State University. Kevin Allison, Northern Great Plains Program Manager for American Bird Conservancy, and Sandy Johnson, Conservation Biologist for the North Dakota Game and Fish Department in Southwest North Dakota, where they have partnered on a project to deploy satellite and cellular transmitters on long-billed curlews. I'm Mike Anderson with the North Dakota Game and Fish Department.
We're here looking for long-billed curlews, the largest shorebird in North America, hoping to be able to find some nests and then therefore be able to trap adult birds and ideally outfit them with satellite or cellular transmitters that can give us data remotely. And so we can just be armchair biologists and collect data on their movement throughout the year. And the main goal is to get information on habitats and regions that are important to them, not just while they're here in North Dakota, but while they're here in North Dakota and during migration, during the long non-breeding season, and then spring migration again.
The North Dakota Game and Fish Department is providing funding for this project, both through our State Wildlife Grants Program, but also our non-game fund, the Watchable Wildlife Tax Checkoff monies. The grant provides money for the transmitters, for their time to come out here and put the tags on the birds. The long-billed curlew is one of our species of conservation priority.
It's about the size of a sharp tail, but on stilts, and with that scythe-like bill that is really well-known. People recognize that quite a bit. People who are outdoors see that. It really grabs their attention.
They're a species that occurs across the Great Plains and the Intermountain West and winters from California mostly, but there are some up into Oregon, down into Mexico, and over to Texas. They're a species of concern because of population declines, and they're also seen as an indicator species for the health of grasslands, but even agricultural lands. And so I'll say that curlews are pretty much a generalist grassland bird. And I think the fact that they're declining is maybe even more reason for concern, because I think given that they're a generalist and they're pretty readily adaptable, they can use crop fields, they'll nest in alfalfa or wheat or corn stubble, and they'll also nest in like the best pasture or prairie out there. And so the fact that they're able to adapt to human modifications to the landscape suggests that it takes kind of a lot to push them over the edge. And so the populations that are declining, there's probably one thing that's really wrong, or maybe multiple things interacting that are all causing some limiting factors.
Long-billed curlews are only here for a couple months, and then they migrate, and then they're on the Texas coast or coastal states for, you know, 7, 8, 9 months. So it's really important to learn more about, you know, are we all doing our part to make sure that this bird has safe places all along the way?
Birds arrive to this area anywhere between like 7 to 10 days into April to mid to, you know, say second or third week of April. We have to find a nest, at least the way we know how to trap these birds. We have to find a nest because we use the nest as the central place where these birds are trappable, because they have such a strong tie to that nest, they don't want to give that away. And so in general, the males incubate from say 6 p.m. until 7:30 or 8 in the morning. And then the females, who have been off the nest all night, return to the territory. Sometimes they're nearby, but sometimes they're a mile or two away. Return, maybe feed a little bit, and then switch onto the nest. And then the male has the day, sort of a combination of feeding and on patrol, and then in the evening he'll switch back on. So we have the most success being on site by sunrise and watching for those first 2 or 3 hours of the day and hoping to catch a single female who's only single because her mate is occupied on a nest. And then once you find a nest, then it's actually carrying an 18 meter mist net. But in this case, we're actually carrying the net parallel to the ground and holding it over the ground and working our way out towards a nest with a director behind us, and then ideally lowering that net on top of the incubating bird. As you're lowering the net, they jump up into the net. And so that's it, capture them, detangle them as quickly as you can, and then move usually at least 200 meters away from the nest to be able to do all the processing and putting a band on the bird, taking measurements, and then finally putting on a satellite transmitter with a harness. So it's a leg loop harness that would attach and sit on the rump of the bird, but the harness goes down between their legs and up and around and ties. So it's basically like a fanny pack with, you know, my analogy is it's like one of us carrying, you know, a half liter bottle of water. That's roughly the proportional body mass that we're adding. So just in terms of thinking about how much impact do we have on the birds, I think it's a really important consideration to make sure we're not causing harm to these birds while we're gathering this data. But we found that these birds do quite well with these transmitters. Pretty quickly, they resume normal activity, go back to their nest, and many of these birds have migrated and given us amazing data.
Lifespan on those transmitters is usually a year and a half, so that's how long the data will be coming in.
We have three different types that I'm carrying with me this year. This is actually a satellite transmitter with the long antenna. It has two solar panels to just getting GPS locations from satellites. And then I have two different cellular technology transmitters. So this is cellular tracking technologies. In addition to the USGS aluminum band with an 8 or 9 digit unique number that we put on one leg, we'll put an alpha flag, sort of a color band with a 2-letter or alphanumeric code, which then makes it recitable even if the transmitter stops working.
Four for sure, but we have 9 tags with us that we want to put out in the Dakotas, so if weather and conditions are allowing, then we can get all those out.
Parental care is relatively equal for the first, say, 10 days after hatching, and then the females tend to abandon and they move and start to fatten for migration, and the males then care for the young until roughly 30 days or so. And so part of it's that the males have that additional burden, and it seems pretty egalitarian, right? The female's putting a ton of work into laying these monstrous eggs proportion to body size, and so the females do a lot of the work, you know, at the front end, and then the males do at the back end. By tracking both sexes, we're able to see that so far no pairs have traveled even remotely close to each other for the winter. And so my ideal on this trip would be to tag females and males. We'd love to get a 50-50 sample size if we can, to be able to sample both and just see if there's differences. We've tracked, I honestly don't remember how many pairs we've tracked now, at least 10, and never have the two individuals migrated to the same wintering site. They always go to different sites, say at least 50 or 100 miles apart, sometimes many hundreds of miles apart, and yet somehow they find each other again in the spring easily. Like come back and like, oh, hey, it's you, how's your winter?
To learn more about how they're using a North Dakota landscape, how they're using grasslands and cropland, and all that's important, wetlands, but also how long does it take them? What path are they taking to migrate south? And then once they get south to their wintering area, you know, what type of habitats are they using there?
Landowners are great partners. Obviously, in the Great Plains, the vast majority of the land is owned and managed by private landowners. And Great Plains wildlife, if you think about it, has always been maintained. Habitats have been maintained by disturbance. Long ago it was bison and fires. Now it's through the actual land management of landowners moving their cattle and other activities like mowing hay and planting crops. So private landowners on working lands have been great partners. Most are really open and concerned about the wildlife that they interact with, particularly birds. I mean, we think about meadowlarks, it's kind of their soundtrack at work. They notice changes in what's happening with the wildlife and get curious about it as well, and they care about being good stewards for the land and the wildlife out there.